I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas on one of the most influential political theorists and liberal intellectuals of the 20th century.
Berlin always thought of the thinker not as a specialist in some discipline, even a humane discipline, but as someone who reflects upon human life itself, someone who has a vision of human life to communicate, not a doctrinal vision or an ideological vision or a political vision necessarily, but a broad vision of human life. And that came naturally to him because he was partly formed by Russian culture, by the Russian experience, in which writers and thinkers such as Alexander Herzen, one of his great heroes, 19th century Russian liberal, and in a different context, Tolstoy, about whom he wrote very profoundly. Such thinkers were, for him, doing what thinkers, in a sense, ought to do.
John Gray, former fellow at Jesus College, Oxford, and colleague there of Isaiah Berlin. Born in what is now Latvia and was then part of Russia, Berlin witnessed the 1917 revolution as a child. In 1920, his family left the country for good and settled in England, where Berlin won a scholarship to Oxford and became the first Jew ever elected to All Souls College. But his curiosity and appreciation were not confined to academic circles.
You know, Berlin was not a snob. Berlin was an intellectual to the tips of his fingers, but he respected people who weren't. He knew there was a kind of intellectual snobbery that you still see among a lot of academics and others who say, oh, how could that person possibly get elected? He's not smart enough. But, I mean, he understood that there's different kinds of smart. You look at the leadership of Canada, and I think Sir Isaiah Berlin would have admired Jean Chrétien in many ways. I think he would have said, this is a practical, smart guy. He knows how to read a room. He knows how to get things done. And that's got nothing to do with so-called intelligence or so-called intellectual intelligence. It's got to do with horse sense.
That was Bob Rae, former New Democratic Premier of the province of Ontario, talking about his teacher at Oxford, Isaiah Berlin. This is Bob Rae's undergraduate roommate, Berlin biographer Michael Ignatieff.
It's as a psychologist of our traditions, of our fatal weaknesses, our fatal longing for a certainty which rational life cannot deliver to us, that I think he'll be remembered. He's one of the great psychologists of liberal culture. The other thing that's terribly important to me, and I hope he will be remembered for, is as an example of what the intellectual vocation is. I mean, this fantastically Catholic range, his sense that you can't do philosophy unless you do history, and you can't do good history unless you do philosophy. The bringing together of those two disciplines in a creative dialogue. And then in a much more personal way, he associated the intellectual life with joy. And in a century in which we associate intellectual life with alienation, suffering, disillusion, that's what I loved about him as a man and what I revere about him as an example.
Isaiah Berlin died in 1997. People in and around politics have been battling over his legacy ever since. Tonight on Ideas, we look first at the life and then at the legacy in a program called Then We Take Berlin.
First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
The program is prepared and presented by National Post reporter Andy Lamy.
Isaiah Berlin once wrote that deep within every philosopher, there's an inner citadel. Inside this hidden fortress is where philosophers keep their deepest, most fundamental beliefs, often very simple ones, general impressions about the world or even intuitions. The philosopher's complicated arguments, Berlin suggested, are essentially defensive, designed to protect their inner citadels from attack. Put aside the idea of attack, or more properly, debate, which you'll hear about later in the program, what's interesting here is Berlin's belief in the importance of gut-level convictions. Even the most complex, abstract argument has them lurking just below the surface. Berlin might as well have been writing about himself. We're going to peer inside Berlin's inner citadel, using a technique he perfected, going from the outside in, beginning with his life and times. In 1969, Richard Nixon was President of the United States, Brezhnev was in power in the Soviet Union, and Berlin was a professor of politics at Oxford, taking it all in. So, if you'd been an undergraduate then, and your interest was in politics, chances are you might have studied with him in tutorial. That's how Bob Rae, the former Premier of Ontario, came to know Berlin and his ideas. Bob Rae.
My tutor, who was a wonderful guy called Bill Weinstein, said, "Would you like to study with Isaiah?" I said, "Who do you mean?" He says, "Oh, Isaiah Berlin." I said, "Good heavens, of course I would love to." So two of us, a fellow who now teaches politics in state in England, an American called Joe Femia, he and I went over to see Isaiah once a week for a couple of hours, and we'd write papers, and we'd discuss the issues of the political philosophy that we were trying to understand, and we'd also talk about anything that came into Isaiah's head. I mean, he was a man of huge interests. He was very interested in politics, very interested in practical politics, very interested in the issues of the day, very interested in what was going on in North America and the U.S., very knowledgeable about U.S. politics, and tremendous fun. He was a very funny man, very engaging, probably one of the greatest two or three conversationalists I've ever met, but he also loved to listen. He was a reasonably good listener for somebody who was so smart and had so much to say and had so much experience. Basically, that was my brief life. I guess it was about a 10-12 week association in terms of the time that we studied together, and he was a very fine man.
In spite of the fact that it was brief, Ray's experience was typical. Berlin left a lasting impression on him, as he did on so many others in over 30 years of teaching. But in the 60s, there was an added urgency. Communism was in vogue among left-wing students. New books were coming out by popular academics like Herbert Marcuse and psychoanalyst Erich Fromm. Berlin had always opposed Marxism. Now his opposition was fiercely relevant. Stephen Lukes, a colleague and friend, first came to know Berlin by sitting in on his lectures.
He had, as his audience, I have to say, to make an autobiographical remark, he had students, left-wing students of his, who he thought were in danger of being seduced by Marxism. And when he thought about the impact of ideas on practical life and political life, when he theorized about this, he had really, for the most part, communism in mind, which was monistic in his terms, that's to say, promising a perfect world, and which had created such devastating consequences throughout the Soviet Empire. That was his preoccupation. He was very, very interested in conflicts between liberty and equality, justice, what values have to be foregone when political choices are made. I mean, on the one hand, I know he believed, that for many, many practical choices that we face, especially in politics, what we have to do is engage in trade-offs. We've got to somehow just minimize the suffering and try and find a compromise.
Did his views have any effects on the views of the young Bob Rae?
Yes, they did. Probably mainly two. One was he forced me to come to terms with the really profoundly illiberal and illogical elements of Marxist type thinking. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. You had, you know, Marcuse writing, you had a lot of stuff coming out about Marx that talked about what a humanist he was and, you know, what a libertarian he was. You had the works of people like Erich Fromm trying to put Marx in a different perspective.
And you were sympathetic to this wave of
Marx? I wouldn't say I was sympathetic, but I mean, I was influenced. It was in the air, let's just say. And I think that Isaiah just kind of firmed things up. The great sort of quality that he had was just forcing you to think, you know, follow that through. Where does that take you? What's the consequence of that? And forced you to come to terms with it.
And that was the second effect he had?
No, I think the second major influence was personal. I mean, I think he was a very civilized man in terms of his relationships and how he built his relationships and sustained them over time and across continents. And that's an important influence on me and I think anybody who came in touch with him.
Berlin befriended people who weren't intellectuals, who never taught at Oxford, and who disagreed with him politically. He didn't care. He was meeting some of the most famous names of the 20th century.
that really isn't an exaggeration. I mean, everyone from Einstein to Freud to Greta Garbo to Churchill to Roosevelt. And yet, at the same time, he was very accessible and open to everybody who came in his path. The number of people who count themselves as his friends was enormous. That was part of his range of reference.
You think then there was a link between his personal identity and his philosophical concerns?
Certainly there was. He lived his philosophy, and his philosophy was very much part of his life. I mean, he was born in Latvia. He was a Jew, of course, which was very centrally important for him. He had seen the Russian Revolution himself, in some sense. I mean, he'd seen an act of violence in which a policeman was taken by the Bolsheviks. That had a very profound impact on him. He became an English schoolboy at St. Paul's School and then Oxford. And then he got involved in very high politics in the 1940s because he was working at the British Embassy in Washington, sending back dispatches to Churchill. And then, of course, he was an analytic philosopher in the empiricist tradition. So I've already mentioned several different, really very diverse kind of identities which were all part of his personality and which led him, of course, to reflect upon how you can hold the different, very diverse parts of a single life together and what you do about value conflict.
You heard Stephen Lukes mention value conflict, and earlier he referred to trade-offs. These were central elements in Berlin's philosophy. With them, he launched a new way of thinking about morality. In his own life, Berlin identified three major strands that made radically conflicting moral claims on him. And from there, he was able to philosophize about others. Berlin biographer Michael Ignatieff.
There was an English identity which gave him the propositional content of his liberalism. There was a Russian identity which gave him his essentially aesthetic and emotional commitments and much of the subject matter of his best essays. And there was this Jewish allegiance, the most fundamental of all. And I think because he sensed that he himself was layered into three identities, he sensed that most people were layered, and therefore that most people's moral life internally was lived as a set of conflicts between various identity claims within themselves. I think that then made it possible to him to see moral life in those terms as a competition among incommensurable, self-contained moral systems, each of which made claims. Jewishness made moral claims on his identity, made moral claims on his life. Englishness made counterclaims that pulled him in another direction. Russianness pulled him in another way. I think when you have that deeply lived sense of inner division, I think it creates at least the psychological preconditions for thinking seriously about value pluralism.
And there you have it, value pluralism, the term most associated with the philosophy of Isaiah Berlin. Break it down into parts, and what have you got? Philosopher Daniel Weinstock.
Well, I think before we can understand what value pluralism is, we have to understand roughly what a value is. Value is, to put it as simply as I can, something that is worth pursuing, a worthwhile end of human activity. Now, value pluralism is the idea that those worthwhile ends can't all be expressed in terms of the same currency. There's no one big value that you could reduce or express all of the other values in terms of. Imagine that you have on a given day to choose how you're going to allocate an hour of your time, and that can be done either by devoting time to your children or by devoting time to your career, right? And you can't do both. For some reason, the resource, as we all know sadly, of time is limited, and there's an hour that we can do one with or the other with. So to give you a contrast, one of the philosophical traditions that Berlin was at pains to argue against was utilitarianism, the idea that at the end of the day, there's something called utility, which is the balance of pleasure over pain, preferences satisfied as opposed to preferences frustrated, that all other values can be expressed in terms of. So if you're a utilitarian, you'll try to figure out how much utility you can get out of spending time with your children and how much utility you can get out of pursuing your career, and you'll do the one that, to the best of your reckoning, gets you more utility. A value pluralist is someone who says that It's just two very different things, right? Two very different ends that you're pursuing through your devotion to your family and your commitment to your career. You have to pick one of the two, but you don't have a common currency that will help you pick between the two. Berlin, again, to go back to Berlin, was keenly aware of the tragic dimension of human lives, namely that there are certain times where we have to pick and we have nothing more to go on than just the necessity to pick. We have no recourse to some kind of ultimate value that could help us.
We have to recognize that we see a great number of things that are good that don't all fit together easily, and very often in certain circumstances don't fit together at all. We should really recognize there's a tragic dimension to human life, and that's the way to ensure a more humane politics in the end, for what human relations and society ought to be.
Philosopher Charles Taylor. You're going to be hearing a lot about the tragic dimension of life and what Berlin referred to as tragic choice. And you'll hear the term goods used as a synonym for values.
The idea that there must be some harmonious solution out there where all the values come together is a very, very dangerous idea. It means that we are going to stop recognizing important things that are good. It means we're going to try to force people and force situations into artificial shapes in order to match our belief that we can bring everything out together. And what that does is it removes entirely the sense of tragic choice. And that means that you do the action that gives you the highest payoff. And of course, there are other payoffs, lesser payoffs, that you have to give up to get a higher payoff. But I mean, that's not a problem because you're not really losing something intrinsically differently good. You're just losing a smaller quantity of the same coinage. So you go in this direction, you know, you balance the budget as against not balancing the budget, and that produces a certain amount of hardship, but it produces more goods later on. You aren't worried about the hardship you're producing because it's perfectly canceled out by exactly the same kind of good in larger quantity. Whereas if you really think of it in terms of, you know, justice versus equality, freedom versus justice and so on, you have a real wrench in your heart as you're forced to make a trade-off which loses some of one or the other. You have a sense that you are, that we're rejecting something that's profoundly good. And that, I think, is Berlin's view, and it's closer to the real human predicament, right? And that, I think, is an important part of what he meant by incommensurable.
Another Berlin term, incommensurable. We can't measure two things by the same standard, but we must choose. Berlin thought liberalism, and its emphasis on freedom of speech, religion, inquiry, best respected this need for choice. He called himself a liberal, and in doing so, was locating himself in a tradition that stretched back to the Enlightenment of the 18th century. But his attitude toward the Enlightenment was complicated. Certainly he shared its skepticism toward superstition. But Berlin, probably more than any other liberal philosopher, also placed enormous importance in what he called the counter-Enlightenment. Berlin coined this term, using it to describe some of the rudest, most offensive philosophers who ever wrote. He believed that the more we cherish the values of the Enlightenment, the more we have to grapple with those who attacked it head-on. Stephen Lukes.
He found it more interesting to read the enemies than his friends. He wanted to see what the weak spots of the Enlightenment were. As he said in several places, he was interested in the enemies of the Enlightenment because they penetrated the defenses. For example, the most fierce and the most relentless was Joseph de Maistre, extreme reactionary and believer in the fundamental evil of man's nature and the necessity for ruthless force to keep human beings in any kind of order. For de Maistre, the executioner was the central figure of any decent social order. I mean, any social order that could survive, the hangman. But there was also Hamann, about whom he wrote very powerfully, German pietist, you know, who had deeply suspicious of abstract conceptual thought, who thought that what we should rely on was instinct and feeling and faith. Other German romantics who were anti-rationalist in various ways. Georges Sorel, who believed in myth, the susceptibility of human beings to myths as being an essential component of their being able to act collectively. I mean, these thinkers, critics of liberalism and critical intellectuals, these were the people whom, as I read, in order to see what they had to say that might be troubling to a defender of the Enlightenment, which is what he was.
the really great goals of the Enlightenment are really terribly important human goals. I mean, just to mention, democracy, equality, human rights, there haven't been finer or more noble political aims in the history of humanity in a certain sense put before us, and we should certainly continue attempt to establish them. But it's just impossible to do that unless we have, I would say this, a deeper understanding of human motivation and its variety. And the problem with a great many of the great Enlightenment thinkers is their psychology is so shallow. And what you find with a great many of the counter-Enlightenment thinkers is they have a deeper sense of the meaning of belonging, the meaning of identity, the meaning of community, the meaning of nation in people's lives. And they may take it in the wrong place, but we've got to learn from them in order to be able to carry out this program of, let's say, democracy, equality, and human rights in a humane, effective, and not destructive way. So you can't do that without reading these people, the famous counter-Enlightenment. So if you like, soak in the counter-Enlightenment in order to carry out the Enlightenment program. I think that's what Berlin was about, and that's, I entirely agree with that.
Michael Ignatieff.
The great thing about his thought was its realism, its anti-perfectionism, his sense that people have deep emotional attachments to land and country and nation, to their traditions of origin, to their myths. It's pious and stupid for liberals to walk around pretending we should discard these, we should be high-minded, we should be simply contractarian and civic. These are real attachments, and I think on balance, he's got that mixture right.
And yet, he wrote repeatedly about the inescapability of tragic moral choices.
Yes, his liberalism is absolutely characteristic in its emphasis on tragic choice. But his mature thought is framed against the backdrop of what he always regarded as the darkest century there had ever been, a sense that two totalitarianisms had sacrificed, you know, upwards of 50, 60 million lives. And his whole, I think, mature thought is devoted to simply understanding why it was that this totalitarian temptation developed within the roots of Western rationalism. And that focus put a tremendous emphasis on tragedy, since here was a totalitarian hecatomb of victims created out of what was best in the Western tradition, its faith in human reason, its faith in human power. And he wanted to understand how tragic results could come out of these essentially optimistic and hopeful Enlightenment beginnings.
Even rationalism, grounds for so much Enlightenment optimism, pursued to the extreme, can lead to monomaniacal thinking. For Berlin, it was the kind of thinking that led to totalitarianism. The need to recognize plural values becomes obvious.
On Ideas, you're listening to Then We Take Berlin, your guide through the life and philosophy of Isaiah Berlin, the great 20th century teacher, writer, and political thinker, is Andy Lamy.
Imagine you're a member of the French Resistance in World War II. Your assignment is to blow up a bridge just as a Nazi official is driving over it. The operation is critically important for the liberation of your country. But it can only be carried out on one night. The same night, your mother wants you by her bedside. She's dying of a terminal illness, and your presence is her only comfort on her deathbed. You feel the claim of both values, family and nation. Now the night has come, and you have to choose. I've borrowed this example from Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous existentialist. He thought it showed morality was irrational and therefore false. I think what it really dramatizes is Isaiah Berlin's idea of tragic choice. In value pluralism, two values can both contain real moral truths, yet be utterly impossible to achieve together. The only thing we can be sure of is the need for a realm of liberty in which to choose. That's the argument Berlin made in the 50s when he first wrote about value pluralism. But in the 90s, a new view has sprung up. John Gray first came to prominence in Britain as an enthusiastic liberal theorist. But now he's recanted, and he's written a book using Berlin's own philosophy of value pluralism as anti-liberal ammunition.
The view I take has been that although there is, of course, in the real world, a tremendous degree of overlap between liberal political philosophy and what might be called pluralism, that overlap is not complete. One might say, for example, just to illustrate that, that it doesn't follow from the fact of ethical life that choice should be privileged in every case or be given an absolute overriding value, because it might be that choice could be regarded as one value among many which can squeeze out, crowd out, or undermine other values. When, for example, anarchy is a risk, then, very predictably in human experience, the great majority of human beings will seek protection from anarchy over liberty.
I'm wondering, Berlin, did he ever have a reaction to your book? Did he ever share with you what he thought?
He did, yes. I mean, he, of course, didn't accept the principal final argument of the book, which is that there is this deep tension between liberalism and pluralism, in which it's pluralism that prevails. Although, in conversations I had with him, he did recognize that to be a real tension. That's to say, without necessarily accepting my argument, which is that when that happens, it's pluralism that's the deeper truth, he never really endorsed that. But the purpose of the book was to present a set of reasonings that Berlin's thought really challenged some recent traditions in ethical, and some old traditions for that matter, in ethical and political philosophy.
Challenges liberalism primarily. That's what Gray means. He thinks that liberals who take Berlin's idea of value pluralism as a point for their side are badly confused. In effect, Gray is picking up Berlin and carrying him down to his end of the political playing field, making him an even more thoroughgoing value pluralist than he was. That's a move liberals don't like. Now, they're fighting back.
I think that people like myself who want to see Berlin as, in the end, putting together a convincing argument for liberalism, namely for the priority in politics of a space for individual liberty, have to show that there's something wrong with Gray's interpretation.
Daniel Weinstock.
The argument that Gray makes is that, in a sense, if Berlin had been fully, maximally coherent, he wouldn't have been a liberal, and he would have accepted that different ways of organizing politically the different values that human beings aspire to are equally satisfactory. But on the other hand, Berlin thought that liberty does have a kind of a special place amongst the values. Any set of plausible, humanly acceptable values has to include at least a certain degree of liberty for the individual in order for that individual to be able to take up what Berlin thought was his or her fundamental human responsibility of choosing for himself or for herself without the intervention of an external sanction like the government. Liberty is a threshold notion for Berlin. Beyond that threshold, trade-offs are entirely possible, consonant with the general thesis of value pluralism. So perhaps at first glance, paradoxically, you have to accept a certain amount of liberty as a condition for any plausible set of values.
Most of the time, liberals and pluralists will march together against any type of totalitarianism because that will attempt to impose a spurious and coercive harmony on the conflicts of human experience and desires. And they'll also march together against any type of fundamentalism for the same reason. I suppose where they would differ would be with regard to regimes that are not totalitarian and not fundamentalist, but in which the full range of liberal freedoms isn't guaranteed. Singapore might be an example. Or before that, Hong Kong, before it was taken over. Hong Kong was in some ways a liberal society, but of course it wasn't a democracy at all. And that kind of variability is offensive to a certain kind of doctrinal, or as I would call them, fundamentalist liberal. If you're a fundamentalist liberal who thinks that the same values, the same liberties, the same regime is universally desirable in the same way everywhere, then you'll find that variation troubling.
In two parts. The first will consist in saying, it's possible, I think, at least it was perhaps before the great crashes of the East Asian economies, to look at places like Singapore and say, well, they're not so bad. They're doing economically better than we are. Their rate of growth is phenomenal. And perhaps part of the reason why that's so is that the government has a tight rein on unions, or there aren't any unions, or what have you. You know, perhaps there's something to be said for this way of organizing society. And these societies are becoming much more vivid to us, much more present as perhaps real options for our societies, as globalization puts them in our living room, as it were, every night. On the other hand, and this is something that has to be emphasized, I think that the stake is to understand what the enduring value of liberal democracy is, given the existence, if we believe in it, of value pluralism, the importance of an irreducible sphere of liberty in human life, which may at the end of the day be counterproductive, which may at the end of the day mean that our societies are slightly more chaotic, less easy to organize economically than others. But there is an enduring value to that way of life, which isn't reducible to economic well-being, and that we have good reason to passionately argue for.
So liberty would be a necessary but not a sufficient condition for a minimally decent society.
Oh, absolutely. Berlin wanted politics to be fairly simple and boring so that in civil society, as much of the rich array of values that people can legitimately pursue are able to manifest themselves. So, I mean, I think that we have a tendency, and this goes back to the basic core idea of Berlin's work as a whole, we have a tendency to think that if our most fundamental commitments aren't embodied in our politics, then something's wrong with our politics. I think that Berlin would say, no, on the contrary, there's something right about our politics if our fundamental commitments, if the values that we most admire, aren't reflected in our politics, because we'll disagree about the values that we should most admire. And whereas it isn't a problem trying to promote these values in our personal lives and in the associations that we freely enter into with others in civil society, once we try, you and I, to place our fundamental, most cherished values in a system of government, well, we'll run roughshod over those that don't share the value. And if we think sufficiently strongly about their rational superiority, we will begin to think nothing of denying them their fundamental rights and sometimes doing violence to them. I think that that is a very thin interpretation, can account for a lot of the historical excesses of governments that started off with, at first glance, very engaging and seemingly humanistic political programs. I think that that's really where the stake is at.
The most inspiring political vision we can hope for, liberals say, is that politics never become too inspiring, that is, too controlling. A scrappy world, teeming with arguments. Neighbors who hector and needle us about convictions deeply opposed to our own. These are the irreducible elements, the subatomic particles of a democratic universe. The liberal idea that governments should leave their peoples free to choose their values for themselves is so widespread, today, it verges on a platitude. But not for value pluralists like John Gray. In this debate, everything hangs on examples. Abortion, euthanasia, gun control. Take one of them, gun control. Do we have ultimate difference, incommensurable values, coming into conflict here? Or just plain old disagreement? Here's what John Gray thinks.
If you actually look at the debate in the United States, a lot of it is a disagreement about whether policies will work, what will be their consequences, who's got these guns, whether they can be removed from criminals, and so on. So a lot of it is actually empirical disagreement. But there may, at the bottom line, be a disagreement about the kind of society which people want to live. Do you want to live in a society which is safe and in which freedoms which are not really centrally important to the way most of us wish to live are restricted, e.g. the freedom to own guns? That's my own view. I support gun control. Or do you think that does eliminate an important liberty or gives too much power to the state? At that point, what you have is not a disagreement, I don't think. Or it needn't. It can be, as it were, what Berlin in conversation often called plumping. That's to say, you simply here have two different views of what society should be like. Or two different preferences.
I'm wondering, are you not being true to your own view of the world? You've found a way to weigh these two issues, and in your own mind, have found immeasurable.
You may be right about that. It is true that I don't attach much weight to the freedom that's being lost. But I can understand, if you like, in a spirit of Berlinian sympathy, not of sympathy in the sense of endorsing their views, but I can sort of enter into a view of the world in which someone would think that there was a valuable freedom being lost. And that really is incommensurable with my view. And I also think, and this is where incommensurability, I think, comes in, that even if I could persuade them of my views of, if I could persuade them of my view of the empirical facts, that's to say, even if we could eliminate disagreement, I still think there would at any rate be some who oppose gun control who would still oppose it. And at that point, I think we do have something like incommensurability.
Or do we? It seems paradoxical, to me at least, to describe two sides in a gun control debate this way. However we feel about the issue, almost everyone, even as he himself admits, John Gray, has found a way to make up his or her mind. We do sometimes argue with people who disagree with us, and what we reject is the particular judgment they've come to, not the very possibility of judgment itself. If that were true, there'd be no point in arguing in the first place. But there are other ways to think about value conflict. By dropping the term incommensurability and substituting that of incompatibility, Charles Taylor teases out Berlin's thought in the context of history. Charles Taylor.
If you look at this across history, you can see that the degree of conflict and the kind of conflict changes greatly from situation to situation. But the real core of it is not incommensurability, but the incompatibility. So you could have goods that were incommensurable in the sense that you wouldn't hope to have any common coinage, but you could believe that they were perfectly compatible. So it's not inconceivable that you can give yourself a goal to develop a kind of situation where two things that are now incombinable will at least be, let's say, less incombinable. The trade-off, if you like, will occur at a higher level of both goods. It is, in other words, written in stone or in logic that these two are always going to be incompatible. I mean, take a really good historical example. In the late 18th century, almost everybody believed that democracy, really ruled by the people, was incompatible with public order. There would be, you know, the mobs and the impossible to have any kind of stable order and defense of property and so on, and that's why most people were against democracy. Now, strangely enough, we developed a universe in which, I would say, practically the only stable societies in around 2000 in our universe are democratic societies. Partly it's because democracy doesn't quite mean the same thing, but partly it's that we've developed political cultures in which stability and democracy can go together. Now, we may have lost something else in the process, but that problem, that combination, which looked absolutely impossible 200 years ago to most observers, we've now brought about a compatibility. So none of these verdicts is final, is my view in history. On the other hand, there are so many of these that to think that in 200 years, well, it's ridiculous. But there is no single one of these problems that we can't in some way hope to work on. That's my optimism, if that's the right word.
But that's 2020 hindsight. For a practicing politician, the challenge is immediate. There's a need to take diversity into account and juggle it with liberty. So conflicts and value pluralism take on a very different and practical meaning. This is what Bob Ray got out of Isaiah Berlin.
My response to liberal civil society is very much influenced by Berlin. His commitment to tolerance and his belief in liberty, and his understanding that politics is about making choices. I think there are areas where you say, how do we make a difference for people if we don't intervene? Recognizing that when you intervene, you are affecting the position of some other people. You have to balance priorities where there's a clash of values. I mean, we're dealing with this internally in Canada, but we're dealing with it all over the world. The most difficult political situations, whether it's in the Middle East, in former Yugoslavia, or in the former Soviet Union, or in Northern Ireland, the most difficult political conflicts have to do with conflicting senses of value and identity, and people unable to share space because they can't fashion a governing structure that allows them to share the same geographic space. The key to understanding Berlin's approach to life and to approaching his philosophy is that these things are never absolutes, and that the biggest mistake you can make in politics is to say, well, this principle is so important that it leads us to go down this road, it can lead to quite chaotic consequences. And that's, I think, an important part of Berlin's approach to life. I think it's a very practical approach. I think he's right.
In 1945, Isaiah Berlin was stationed in Russia as a British embassy official. On a visit to Leningrad, he went to see the poet Anna Akhmatova, voice of the Russian conscience before and after the revolution. They talked all night. Akhmatova was working on her Poem Without a Hero, and she recited part of it for him. In the final version, Berlin would appear as the guest from beyond the looking glass, a reminder of a world she could only long for. His meeting with Akhmatova changed Berlin's life. He had seen her voice silenced by Soviet tyranny. He responded with a philosophy of freedom. It was a sharp break from the arid apolitical philosophy in which he'd been trained at Oxford in the 30s, that set out to translate life into abstract logic, taking science as its model. Daniel Weinstock.
Berlin was, in his early years at Oxford, an early protagonist of analytic philosophy, and of an analytic philosophy which had extremely ambitious pretensions. The people that Berlin was talking to thought, for example, that it was in principle possible to imagine a language, a scientific language, not like English or French or what have you, but a scientific code through which we could neutrally record all our observations so that regardless of the scientific point of view from which you're talking, be it chemistry or physics or what have you, there would be the possibility of translation and discussion between these different levels of language. It was a very, very Promethean program, and Berlin became disaffected with it because it seemed entirely too reductive and entirely too ignoring of the complexity of human life. Now, he decided to abandon philosophy and go out and do the history of ideas. One more thing about Berlin, which comes out in some of his writings, Berlin, as the great historian of philosophy, unexcelled historian of philosophy and history of ideas that he was, tended to take a kind of long view of the history of philosophy, and at various points in his writings said the following thing. Look, how many great turning points in philosophy have there been? 5, 6, maybe Aristotle, maybe the Renaissance humanists. There aren't that many thinkers who have really shattered the ground beneath them and made us think about the fundamental questions of human existence in a different way. But if you view philosophy as a grand collaborative enterprise where one person will build on the little step of his predecessor and so on and so forth, then all of a sudden it does begin to seem worthwhile. And one wishes Berlin had been more impressed by the little successes and less overwhelmed by the huge earth-shattering transformations.
So perhaps in a way then this debate about Berlin that's now going on is a kind of endorsement of your view of philosophy and a rejection of his. People are saying to Berlin, you know, maybe you aren't Aristotle or so, but we think there's something at stake in these ideas, and they're not grand philosophical achievements, but you've hit on something here, and it is relevant to our lives. There's something at stake here.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that one of the great influences that Isaiah Berlin has had, in a way, is that one of the great responsibilities of the philosopher is to understand and interpret the philosophical underpinnings of where we are now as human beings, what our civilization is about, what our beliefs are about as well.
The philosopher as interpreter. History presents us with dilemmas where our first duty is to simply understand. And though tragic choices can be defined in philosophical terms, Berlin believed what philosophy couldn't do was solve them. He had a story he used to illustrate why. Stephen Lukes.
I once did an interview with him in which he cited the kind of tragic choices that were faced during the war by Jewish leaders. You know, there's a famous case he talks about where a rabbi is offered the opportunity to save a number of Jews in Hungary by giving the names of the Jews in the community. If he does this, he's told he can escape with 72 chosen people he can choose. Well, should he do this or not? In fact, the leader did do it, this Jewish leader, and was eventually assassinated in Israel. But where we're dealing with tragic choices, like the one I just mentioned, his view was that There's no principle or overarching principle that we can use to decide the matter. He was very deeply hostile to Hannah Arendt because, as he understood her, Hannah Arendt was critical of the Jews who, as she thought, didn't rebel, didn't resist. And Isaiah Berlin's comment on this was, no one, certainly no one far from the situation itself, is in a position to say what's right and what's wrong in that situation. That every choice, which is a very deeply bad choice with terrible consequences, in some sense is the right choice or the wrong choice. There is no, as it were, philosophical key that can unlock this. Hannah Arendt wrote a book about the origins of totalitarianism and, more importantly in this connection, Eichmann in Jerusalem, in which she talked about the banality of evil as a way of talking about Eichmann's crimes. And Isaiah Berlin found this phrase very, very hard to take.
Arendt's provocative phrase, the banality of evil, Berlin felt, didn't measure up to the sheer enormity of the Holocaust. Berlin may also have been too alive to the drama of tragic moral choice to see evil as banal. We can't live without value conflict because we can't live without values. Some philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche most famously, have seen the modern world as being empty. No purposes, no ethics, no genuine human truths. Berlin teaches us that it's teeming with them. Michael Ignatieff.
The thing he's helped me to see about our times is that he's helped me see through a critique of modernity that we can date back to Nietzsche, which is that the problem with modernity is nihilism. The core of Isaiah's philosophy, it seems to me, is an indignant rejection of the argument that our problem is nihilism. Our problem is not nihilism, and it's not relativism either. It's not the problem that no values exist, or that values are simply a matter of taste. Our problem is intrinsic to the human situation and is not affected by modernity at all, in fact. It's that we are faced with conflicts between goods, justice, liberty, mercy. All these, the things we hold dearest, are in conflict. It's not that we don't know what we believe. It's not that we don't have things that we would die for, in fact. It's that we don't know how to square them. These are ancient, ancient difficulties about being human. And I think that's what Isaiah saw. And that's why he thinks the Nietzschean critique, that we're in a kind of, we're in a nihilist world where anything goes and anything is true, is just not the human situation at all. And I think that as people think through his contribution, they can see that that is a persuasive description. Because there's a kind of curious condescension in the argument that the modern situation is a nihilist situation, that the modern situation is a kind of relativist soup. I think the reason why people respond with a sense of emotional recognition to Isaiah's work is that he pays some respect to the embattled sovereignty of private judgment. And that private judgment is not operating in a vacuum, in a sea of darkness. That embattled private judgment is struggling with deeply held convictions. It is a private judgment that actually believes there are objective values, that lying is lying, cruelty is cruelty, pain is pain, and suffering is suffering. These are words we know the meaning of. Justice is justice, mercy is mercy, equality is equality. These are words we know the meanings of. Nietzsche assumes we don't know the meanings of these words anymore. We do know the meanings of these words. What we don't know is how to put them together into a believable and sustainable and non-contradictory life. And that's what Isaiah understood about the anguish of being human. And I think he uncouples our moral situation from modernity. He's saying that our dilemmas and our moral difficulties are not intrinsic to modernity. They're intrinsic to being human.
From an interview he gave when he was in his 60s, ladies and gentlemen, Isaiah Berlin.
What philosophy deals with are the assumptions on which a great many normal beliefs rest. Not the sort of things which people like to dig up, because people sometimes don't really want their assumptions examined over much. People are rather uncomfortable when they're made to look into what really their beliefs rest on. Partly because action itself, perhaps, precludes this kind of thing. Quite obviously, if you're simply actively engaged in some kind of life, constantly to be asked, why do you do this? Are you sure that what the girls which you are pursuing are true girls? Are you certain that what you are doing is not, in some way, it doesn't contravene some kind of moral beliefs which perhaps you ought to hold? Or are you sure that some of your values then conflict with certain other values and you are simply not facing that? That sometimes when you are plunged into some kind of dilemma, you are so frightened of looking it in the face that you avert your gaze and try and get the responsibility upon some other back, on the back of the state, for example, on the back of your teachers, on the back of your class, on the back of some other association to which you belong. Shouldn't you perhaps face this responsibility? This, I think, daunts people. But in fact, the sort of assumptions which a great many ordinary common sense beliefs rest are matters for philosophical analysis. I will say this, that if everybody in a society were skeptical intellectuals constantly examining their own roots, nobody would be able to live at all. And therefore, men of action cannot be called upon, all of them, constantly to be examining themselves. And it's therefore the task of philosophers, who are, I suppose, people particularly curious about these things, to be doing this particular thing. But on the other side, it must be said, that if these things are not examined and left fallow, then societies become ossified. Beliefs turn into dogma, imagination is warped, the intellect becomes sterile, societies decay as a result of simply lying on some comfortable bed of unexamined dogma. If the imagination is to be stirred, if the intellect is to work, assumptions must be questioned. Presuppositions must be challenged. The whole thing has to be constantly looked at, and not by too many, and not too much, perhaps. Nevertheless, sufficiently to keep the society moving. Society moves by some degree of parricide, by which the children, on the whole, kill, if not their fathers, at least the beliefs of their fathers, and arrive at new beliefs. And this is how development occurs. This is what progress is.
Berlin's vision is of intellectual life as a kind of creative destruction, a crucible of radical, even revolutionary criticism. Within it, individual philosophies will rise and fall. But the task of philosophy itself, to attack dogma, to free our minds and our institutions, this value is permanent.
On Ideas, you've been listening to Then We Take Berlin, a look at the life and philosophy of Isaiah Berlin. The program was written by Andy Lamy. Associate producer, Liz Nagy. Sound technician, Dave Field. The producer was Marilyn Powell. We've prepared a transcript of this program. Just send a check or money order for $8, and that includes all costs of handling and mailing, to Berlin, care of Ideas Transcripts, CBC, Box 500, Station A, Toronto. Or you can email us at ideastran@toronto.cbc.ca. We've also prepared a reading list, which is free. Same address. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by the Arts Today and Between the Covers.